Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about pH and how it affects nutrient availability. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at the National Corn Growers Yield Contest results for this year. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about grazing. And Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, followed up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy.
Outside.
It really is cold outside.
One day a cold
day and a half. Tonight's supposed to get it dropped last night, and it's going to stay cold.
It turned fast.
Oh yeah,
maybe that's the big part. The how quickly it got cold.
It turned
and really windy last night too.
But remember, we can't use wind chill anymore.
No, it's cold index or whatever now.
But I still think wind chill makes more sense because. Not in the wind, it was fine. In the wind, it's a bit cold. And then rain, we got rain coming, and just
well,
doesn't know what it wants to do.
It's rain and 40, not like...
Rain and 60?
Rain, well, or 32 and raining, where
it's icy.
It just turns to ice.
Yeah.
Hopefully not a snow squall turning the roads to glare ice like it was last week.
There was even some snow squalls earlier this week, again on Wednesday.
Yeah, there was some.
Didn't turn to ice, luckily, but just...
No, it was just snowy.
Seems to get more and more of those.
Yeah, I would agree.
I feel like for as much as it affects visibility, in the end, there wasn't anything really accumulating that much.
No.
So it looks like way worse than it is, and it just affects the visibility, which sucks.
Did you guys shovel it? I saw people like... One person with snowblower out and some shoveling.
Snowblower?
Yeah, I was like...
I don't think a snowblower even works at that
trying
point,
to,
does
like,
it?
Yeah, make sure it works or what.
Do you have to stick, like, a vacuum pump on the to get it into the impeller?
It slugs in. It just builds up in front, and then a big wad goes through.
I would have gone leaf blower over snowblower.
Yeah, there you go.
We had. Which that I've is, seen that.
That's underrated.
That. Yeah.
The leaf blower?
Yeah.
Well, because the motor heats up the air, so it actually kind of melts it as you... if it's... I mean, yesterday maybe... not yesterday. Wednesday, whenever it was, the snow maybe wouldn't have been warm enough to melt it, but...
Like, which kind of leaf? You need a pretty good...
Well, like a gas part, not an electric.
Right, the electric or, like, plugging in a leaf blower would be annoying.
It would have to be a gas.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Okay.
With an engine that generates heat.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, no, it's definitely a bit chilly, but then, yeah, within a couple of days, it'll be pretty warm again. I feel like that's going to be all winter.
I was just going to say, are we in for this all year long?
It's like, be like, oh, really cold for a couple of days, then warm, then cold.
I guess it's better than a long stretch of warm or cold. I mean, like a, 30 days of this weather. Well,
think about on the farm, too. Like, even talked in the farmers through the cold spell. They're like, this isn't that bad.
No.
And, it's just, that it is, it's where you have, like, a week of very cold.
You can't make any headway because it's just so cold.
Probably not what we want our alfalfa fields to go through all winter. But
No, for them, this is probably a bit of a shock. I mean, really no snow cover and...
Right.
Pretty cold, but they're early and just using their reserves.
Right.
And the ground was pretty hard before.
Yeah.
Right. So it was already frozen.
It should have been somewhat dormant at least at this point.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So you ready to talk about some pH?
Yeah.
I'm ready.
But not like pH as in fat, as in like, you know, hip and cool. pH is in what the pH of
parts
your soil
hydrogen.
Is.
Yeah. pH is in pH.
Acidity.
Is it acidity or is it
basic?
How much basic it is? Alkaline and acidity?
Both.
It's neutral at some point.
Yes.
It's
new. How
zero?
How basic are you, Todd?
Unfortunately, I'm pretty basic. Yes. Yeah. Very true. Very true. So today, Matt, we're talking about... So we've talked about pH liming, its importance, but really this gets to why liming is important, is because it sets up the availability of the rest of the nutrients in that.
Liming if your soil requires it.
Right. Or if you're very high in pH, using an acidic
sulfur-based
thing to try to bring it down. That one's more debatable how to do. But today we're not going to focus on that. We're going to focus on why that is, and basically that nutrient availability is strongly influenced by pH. So it's very important that from a nutrient management standpoint that your pH is correct, because if your pH is where you want it to be, then what we're trying to do is get it where most of those nutrients are available. So that's really the goal. So it's like when we say 6.4 to 6.8 pH, the reason is we're going to talk about, and you'll hear, is that that's because that's where most of the nutrients are most available, is in that range. So some of our listeners may or may not have seen, there's a it's kind of cigar chart is what I call it, because it looks like these bands of...
I like the one you brought up, Todd, because it's colorful. Cigars.
Yeah.
Like there's a black and white one that's like, meh.
It's hard to see sometimes, and it must have...
And then there's the one on the wall that's like multicolored.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, that's a good one. I like that one, too.
The green areas are...
Green is good.
Red is bad.
Yellow is caution. Red is...
But these are... Each individual nutrient has a different color. There's no...
All the colors that are rainbow.
Yeah.
Red, green, blue, yellow.
So, basically, like, you use that to see when the, like, width of the bar is the most wide. That means it's most available, and then it kind of narrows up or moves around. And some have very similar... charts, some nutrients. What's odd is you'd think some of them that like sulfur and nitrogen are kind of similar nutrients in the periodic table, but they actually have they're different
in their availabilities. Yeah.
And then like potassium, sulfur aren't necessarily close on the periodic table, but they have very similar availability. So that is one odd thing, is it doesn't always act the same, but certain ones do. We always talk about calcium, magnesium in the same and similar breaths, and those have similar. So some of these I will group as we're talking about it, but let's start out with the big one is nitrogen. And one nice part about nitrogen is it's really most available between 6 and 8 pH. So it's got a pretty wide range, and it's nice shape that it goes, narrow when it's real acidic, and then right from 6 to 8, right kind of the, if 7's obviously neutral.
It's the window.
You're right on either side.
It's real good shape.
It's real good.
Love the shape of nitrogen.
So it's kind of a nice availability.
It's very javelin shaped.
Yes, it's got it's more the true cigar, kind of fat in the middle, tapering to the ends.
So we're going to skip over phosphorus now. We'll get back to that one, because that one's the odd duck.
But that one looks like a dart.
Yeah, it does look like a dart.
I was going to say torpedo, but that one does look
like a torpedo. Yeah.
So moving on to potassium and sulfur, those have similar. So those are most available
when
it's 6 or more pH. So kind of basically, it can't be very acidic. You want 6 or more. And as you get more, it's the same. So those kind of are very similar. Calcium, magnesium are similar. And that's got a range. So from about 6.8 to 8.5 pH.
Those are very close to nitrogen, but they kind of shifted... More basic.
A little bit basic, yeah. Yep. And then kind of in that same realm actually is boron, copper, and zinc, but those shift to more like 6.8 to 5. So 5 to 6.8. So like we said, at calcium and magnesium are going to be more available in a very basic scenario. And in the more acidic scenario, it's going to be boron, copper, and zinc. And like I said, that's 5 to 6.8.
And boron, I would say that one's more the true torpedo, because it's got the, like the one we're not talking about, phosphorus, that flare at the end where it's like it's available, then it starts kind of being less available, then like, just kidding, boom. Super available, hello.
Let's go to 9 pH, everyone.
This chart I always think
this
is funny.
This
one
goes up to 11.
That the chart does go, the chart we're looking at goes from 4 to 10. Well, if you... Really, the chart probably should go, 5.5? 5, maybe. to an 8.5. Like, it really doesn't. If you're past 8.5, you're gonna have problem. Like, that's just. I do think this chart's unique that way too. That makes me laugh. Of on a normal,
it's the iron availability. I guess is probably why the chart's designed the way it is.
Correct. Yeah. And I also Yeah, and I also nitrogen do understand. Too, yeah. Like, I'm just saying, I've never seen a soil more than 9 pH ever. Have you ever seen a test that high?
Not in the area we work in.
I've seen fours.
Below four.
Yeah, so true. So maybe just on the
not
far.
Not personally, but in a presentation.
Okay.
I've seen some fours.
Yeah, there was like a...
Did they?
I think it was Kara Lebowski had a thing where this weird field they were looking at that had like a 3 pH or something. It was
iron would be available.
Yes. All the iron you could ever want.
Yes.
Which is so important.
So the next one we're going to talk about is iron and manganese, and those are going to be more available less than 6.8 pH. So they like it kind of on that more acidic side. And then molybdenum, or moly, everybody's calling it moly.
They are, yeah.
Everybody's saying the moly.
I guess the drug moly must have kind of gone off the wayside. Sure. We can call our nutrients moly now.
So on the moly, it's 6.8 or more pH. Is where it's available. So similar to potassium and sulfur, but those are more like 6, and this is a little bit more
7.
It's a late bloomer.
You do got to be fair. So when we talk about what our ideal pH is, this is why we're talking about. So that's why a lot of, you know, when we're talking corn and soybeans, we say between 6.4 and 6.8 pH is ideal, because you have a higher amount of nutrients available to that plant, available for uptake. And obviously the goal, you know, say we have a lot present in the soil, but if it's not available, it might as well not even be present. You know, it's just, if it's not available, it's not worth, you know, worrying about. So one of the neat charts I did find was it was a crop yields relative to pH. So with this chart, they talked about as pH changes and how good your yield is. So I thought this was neat. But basically at 6.8, you had 100% of your yield for corn, wheat, soybeans, alfalfa, and timothy. And actually for oats, you hit 100% at 7.5 pH. And barley, you also hit 100% at 7.5 pH. So that was unique.
Well, and alfalfa from 6.8 to 7.5
is still 100%. Yeah. So corn, as you get to 7.5 or 5.7, you're around 83 to 85%. So that one you can see, you know, both ways. And I deal with sandy soils that are acidic. I deal with soils that, and I'll be honest, I would take sandy soils that are acidic because we can fix them a lot easier to lime.
Right.
Whereas I think that's interesting to look at that 7.5. I have enough soil tests that the field average is 7.5.
So you should be.
So I'm losing 15% of my corn yield.
Just because of pH.
Just because of pH.
Yeah.
And not easy to change, not easy to change that. Whereas wheat goes from 100 to 99 at a 7.5, so you're losing no yield. And in a 5.7, it's down to 90% on wheat. And then beans doesn't drop as much as corn, so it goes from 100% at 6.8 to 93% at 7.5.
But it's better to be higher than lower, because at 5.7, it's 80%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I really liked this chart a lot, because I think it helped me put in perspective. When you can put in perspective to a percent yield loss, it's a lot easier to start running numbers.
Well, and alfalfa on this chart shows us exactly why I've been harping for years on the proper pH for establishing alfalfa, because look at 5.7
it's less
pH
than half
for alfalfa yield.
Yeah.
Garbage.
And when you're talking to a grower with, you know, you're going through soil tests and you see 5.6, 5.8, 5.9, like, well, okay. But when you tell them, like, yeah, we're at these pHs and the best you can do is 83% of what you could do if it was balanced correctly. Like, you're behind the eight ball before you start.
Right.
go ahead, spend that money on nitrogen and all the rest of it, but you're only going to get to 83. So let's fix that first, right? That's kind of what you're saying, Todd,
right.
Is this is the foundation.
Right.
We got to fix this
first. Try to do what you can to fix it first. And then, and luckily, especially if it's liming, it's pretty reasonably cost. If it's too alkaline or basic, there's other hard parts with that, and it's hard to keep it as you get it lower. So, yeah, that cigar chart that we were talking about earlier is from the National Soil Survey manual. So, I was trying to find the date. It must be super old because even some of the copies of it look ancient. But one of the things it also said that I liked.
I think it was actually on a cave.
Yeah, probably.
Wall somewhere.
Just drawn with.
Just found,
yeah. Next to the caveman and the buffalo. Yeah. Guy on a buffalo.
Ugh. So, nitrogen. So. No good. pH 5.7. Ugh. Sorry, you were saying?
No, I agree. This is that old. So one of the things that I liked what it did say is, so we're talking about, basically it says soil pH levels that are too high or too low tend to lead to deficiency of many nutrients, a decline in microbial activity, decrease in crop yields, and a deterioration of soil health. So even back then when they were putting this on the cave wall,
They knew tilth was important.
Well, yes. Right, and it's so we're specifically talking about nutrient availability, but you also have problems with microbes and with a deterioration in soil health if you don't have this.
Well, how many times do you have that soil that you just look at it and the farmer's like, it's dead?
Right?
Like there's no activity there. And then it's usually lighter soil most of the time. And
well,
there's
and when
just
it,
no activity there.
When it's heavier, too, it's potentially because it's too basic or too alkaline that some of that
compaction,
you know, stuff
fun.
Is different. Yeah. All right. So the one we did skip was phosphorus. And that one's kind of a roller coaster. It's got peaks and valleys. So it's a little bit different to explain, you know, than just this range or this. And that one's a little more fun to explain why, because it actually fixates to other things and reacts with other minerals, you know, in that soil and then becomes unavailable to crops being able to pick it up. So there's three peaks of fixation. So there's a Michigan State study had a really cool chart that kind of showed, you know, at certain pHs it would fixate and then there, you know, and then it would be available and then it would fixate and be available. So the first peak of fixation.
And when you say fixation, it's like a bad unavailability.
Yes, true. It's fixating
to
another
up.
Nutrient. Yeah.
It cannot release.
So the first, you know, peak happens that where it's fixated by iron at from about 3 to 4 pH. So very acidic. So typically we don't run into that problem and that one's very high fixation. So the hill number one is very tightly bound. So if you are that low, you're going to definitely have phosphorus problems. And then between 4 and 5 pH, it'll actually become available again. And you'll have this sort of what we're calling the valley. But, you know, we're in the cigar chart, you have a wider cigar there.
So and the roller coaster is going down the hill and picking up speed, and it's going well.
Yep. So you're feeling good. So, yeah, that's your first. Even it is like a roller coaster because you're going that, you know, the first hill is always a big drop.
Mm-hmm.
It's our big drop. And then we're coming up on our second one is between 5 and 6 pH. And we'll have fixation due to aluminum. Mm. So aluminium will.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Australian British person.
Will adhere, fixate to that phosphorus and start holding it tight. And there, too, it's kind of in the middle as far as how tight it is.
So it's all the beer cans from the field party are locking up the phosphorus.
Are holding it there.
Don't throw your beer cans in the field. It's littering and your screwing up pH.
So, yeah, and to stick with the roller coaster analogy, it's a hill, but it's not as high as the first hill.
But it's high.
But it's high.
Yeah, and even a lot of the reports will show, like, you can You can add as much phosphorus to you want in those first two peaks to, and iron and aluminum will just grab them up.
Grab.
Like you won't be able to get it to that crop.
It's like so, they're magnets.
Yes. So you're way better off applying lime to fix the pH and that'll help it. And so the biggest valley then that we're trying to hope for is between our 6 to 7 pH. That's where we see that dip again and kind of that ideal environment for soil phosphorus and optimal plant growth is in that spot. So that's kind of that part of the ride where you're, you know, you're not to the end, but it's slowing down and you're having a lot of phosphorus availability in that spot. So that's good. And then we get over about, especially 7.5, but over 7, but kind of 7.5 and then 8 is where we have another kind of medium fixation, but that's where calcium starts to bind. And it is more of a weak, you know, bond, but it's still
tying something up.
Right. It's
still a problem.
Right. So there's a spot, though, that the fixation is relatively weak. So you could apply a few more pounds of pea fertilizer in that soil or as try to acidify the soil, obviously. Like, those are your two options. But on the first ones, adding more phosphorus will not help you. This one, you could have enough phosphorus.
Potentially get enough, yeah. Supplemental.
That you're okay.
And from a cost standpoint, it's probably...
I don't know.
Potentially cost effective to add a little more phos than a lot of more sulfur.
Correct.
Especially if you're going for like all elemental sulfur or something, that's going to be a little bit more costly.
The downside is there's other stuff, you know, iron, manganese, boron.
Nutrients affected.
Right. That are still being tightly bound.
Just talking about phosphorus, correct. Todd.
But if you're just talking about phosphorus.
You wanted to just talk about phosphorus.
Yeah. You wanted us to wait, and now you want to go back. Come on.
So I do think this is a really neat, unique chart showing this sort of peaks and valleys. The cigar chart shows that, but like you said, it gets to be this arrow dart.
Dart, yeah.
Dart shaped, and it doesn't sort of explain why. You know, I don't want to say that it's just trickier to know how tight it's holding it. So,
no, either way, it shows that your balance is necessary for good nutrient uptake, and you know it makes a lot of sense when you start to break it apart and look at all the individual nutrients. Even just looking at the big three, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, your range really isn't that big of where you kind of want to target.
All three of them have a big range, but they all don't line up with one another.
Right. They're all more available at different times.
Different pHs. Potassium's
probably got the greatest availability, just looking at the cigar chart and where it starts and stops compared to the other two. But, yeah, it's interesting to look at it. You know, we're always thinking of a lot of things in season. But pH is really something we plan for more out of season.
It should be an out of season.
It's not something you're like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna get let's do a couple tons of potash and let's get 4 tons of lime out here right now. Let's go.
The other consideration that I want to growers think about is stratification. Is a lot of times when I think of stratification, I just think of like like a no-till scenario. And all the nutrients are up on top. But I think there is a pH play to this that you do got to think about, because you might say, well, yeah, all my nutrients are at top and the plant will still get them. But you do want to look at pH, and if your pH is also stratified, how that'll affect all this. So,
well, and potentially in no-till, if you're liming, it's going to really be stratified, right? Because a lot of it's going to stay in the top.
In the top. So before I looked into this, in general, when I looked at pH differences in stratification, there isn't much there usually. So what I would say is just watch for that, though, as you're looking at soil tests for stratification. And if that is a big change, then that's telling you not only do you have a change, you know, that you have something you need to fix, but you have varying availabilities. So say down below, your pH is out of whack, and you're low in fertility because your fertility is all the time. You got a lot more problems because not only is it low in fertility, but you also, what is there? It's not even available. So there wasn't a lot on that, but that did pop up that I thought was interesting, that watching for pH stratification, because if you have that.
I feel like that's really more of a soil issue. Like your soil type probably plays into that more than anything else. Like especially if you're changing soil, like you have, I could see it on like a knob where you've maybe got a transition from like sand to clay or something like that, where you might experience that stratification. But just, and not that I've done a ton of it, but the little bit I've done around in our area, just don't really see the pH changing all that much.
I would agree with you too. Yeah. I will 100% that where I have done stratification, I don't know that I've ever seen it that pH change. So if it does change, like I'm just bringing up one I've got now, it was a 6.8 shallow and a 6.9 deep, 7.7. I mean, it just doesn't happen. So right. Maybe what I'm getting at, if it is different by more than, you know, 0.4, there's something bigger could be going a potential on there that you got to look at. So. Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. There's some things to think about when you're looking at your nutrients and yields, to remember to consider pH and make sure you're balancing that pH in a range which will make the most bang for your buck when it comes to nutrient availability. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So as we near the end of 2024, the 2024 National Corn Growers Association Corn Yield Contest results are out there. And once again, Dave Hula of Charles City, Virginia, has got some big yields of 490.6276 bushel per acre entry for him this year.
That's nuts.
That's a lot of corn. It's the 13th national high yield win of the contest for Hula. His winning entry was in the irrigated strip till category, came with a Pioneer P14830VYHR, the same hybrid he planted to set the contest yield record in 2023, where he saw a yield of 623.843 bushels per acre. He's the only farmer to exceed 600 bushels per acre in the national contest and has done it three times, 2019, 2021, and 2023. So
490 is disappointing.
490 is like a bummer, I guess. I lost 110 bushel from last year. 130 bushel, actually.
Yeah, that's a...
Why do I suck?
That's a 22% decrease right there.
That's a pretty big chunk. Right there.
Come on, step your game up. And you think you're bummed at 490?
Yeah. Whew. Yeah. Especially, I mean.
Well, you didn't even break 500.
Yeah. Right? Just, 500 was probably right there. Yeah. I hit it on the monitor, but didn't average. So
he went 10 feet too far.
Oh, you picked the wrong chunk of the field.
Say that you and I have done these,
yeah,
Bill, and they are. It is. This number is super impressive on the way they have this set up. It's hard to hit these numbers and be consistent. It's one thing to say, well, my monitor hit that in the field or I did this or that, but to be cranking that number across,
he's got to have, I mean, obviously it's Virginia, so it's different.
Correct.
But it's got to be deep soil, like just super, super even, because even just the little soil type changes that we see, you really see on a, like in a small plot. It's a small plot, right? An acre and a quarter is all you have to harvest here, but that's pretty good,
right?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, the article. So it started in 1965. Was the first National Corn Growers Association yield contest. Back then, the average was 2 for the winning yield, only 20 entries, 218.9 bushel to the acre. By 1968, they had 412 entries across 34 states, up to 246.69 bushels that year. And that was in 87. And at that, in 1987, they had 2,500 growers from 45 states. Now, this year, 7,800 contest entries from 45 states and verified yields averaging 284 bushel to the acre for contest entries. So from 218 to 284 in 50-some years. So pretty good yields right there. All right. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So this, we're looking at America's farms and ranches at a glance in 2024. So it's been released for this year. Pulls survey data collected from the end of 2023. The percentage of farms receiving government payments ranged from 21% for small farms to 44%. For mid-size and large dairy farms, small family farms received 76% of all payments from USDA's Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP. Large-scale family farms accounted for the majority of the value of cash grains and soybeans, 52%, cotton was 71%, dairy 77%, and specialty crops 59% of production. Small farms produced 45% of the value of hay and 46% of the total value of poultry and egg output. 22% of the value of beef production occurred on small family farms, while 39% occurred on large-scale family farms. Small family farms often have cow-calf operations, while large-scale are more likely to have feedlots. Most, about 85% of all U.S. farm households, earned the majority of their total household income from off-farm sources. 52% of family farm households had negative farming income. And overall, 42% of farm households have income below the U.S. median in 2023. So hopefully that improves, but
yeah, that was a reading it. It was, we all know what farming's like, so it's not like a surprise, but it was slightly disappointing, you know, or like frustrating.
Yeah, the how well the statistics bear it out.
Yes, right, right, right. So yeah, it was, and it's hard because farm, they define farm size in here right away, and it's tricky because depending how you define all that can really sway the data. So some of this, you know, what you and I wouldn't necessarily consider a farm. You know, it might just be somebody with what a lot of us in the industry call hobby farms, you know, what we'll call that. So it was a little bit interesting to look at that data.
When you compare it on a nationwide average, too, it really kind of dilutes the information. Like,
right.
Because you're dealing with vastly different income levels across areas where the cost of living is very different. Like a California farm, I would struggle to see how they would even make money, just knowing how the economy out there can be, and so yeah, I mean it's just a lot of variables that cover that. Yeah. So,
all right, thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. All you need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone. Or if you have an Android phone, you can search an app like Podcast Addict. And there you can also search Tilth Talk Radio and find us. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcast. And then you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll get into our Cool Beans, That's Corny, and some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Culver's has reached its 1,000th restaurant.
Got a grand.
Yep, and that milestone is occurring in Allen County, Indiana. So the 1,000th location will open up there this month. Located in New Haven, Indiana, the restaurant is set to celebrate its opening on December 16th. Milestone is offering the first 100 guests one free year of free Butterburgers.
Whoa.
Random customers will also receive boxes of Culver's merchandise and coupons. So the opportunity to bring Culver's to New Haven community is incredibly exciting, and to be the 1,000th Culver's location is an honor, according to Ashley Jones, who's the location's owner and operator. Starting at 9:30 opening day, bring the chain's founders, Craig and Lisa Culver, as well as the president and CEO, Rick Silva, and New Haven Mayor Steve McMichael. While the restaurant has yet to open, it's already looking forward to supporting the community. First on its list is local FFA chapters. New Haven Culver's is planning to have share nights in the future where a percentage of its sales will be donated. So only the first 100 people get a year of free Butterburgers, not the first 1,000. You'd think 1,000 stores.
Yeah. I'm sure Craig can afford that.
Think they'll do anything at the other Culver's to celebrate their 1,000th store?
Gotta go. Gotta go there.
Gotta drive all the way to New Haven, Indiana.
It's, did you look up? 6 hour, 24 minutes from us.
Let's go.
It's not terrible.
So we can be there in a couple days. No.
In a day.
Yeah.
A couple days.
It's basically
we're not going by horse and buggy, Todd.
Well, I'm saying we got a couple days to get there, too.
Is it north of Indianapolis? Or?
It's kind of right outside of Fort Wayne.
Oh, okay.
Like, to me, it's Fort Wayne, but sure. You're in a little, like...
suburb of Fort Wayne, most likely.
Yep. So, you're kind of... You're in the... Yeah, that's north. It's good.
Road trip. We got a few days. Get down there.
So, I got a funny opening Culver story.
Do you frequent
new Culver's? No. We just happen to be in the great... city of Sandusky, Ohio.
Did you see Tommy Boy?
Yeah.
No, Tommy wasn't
Was it
there.
Sandusky, Ohio or Sandusky? No.
Yep. So Culver's legitimately like a day or two had opened prior to us getting there. So we're like, hey, you know, you check out Culver's. Well, the drive-through had to have been 40 deep. Ooh. I'm not lying. 40 deep. So we're like, well, let's go in. Okay. So we go in. Nobody at the, like, you could walk right in.
Why was everybody just
I don't know.
In the
Everyone was in the drive-thru. Okay. So we walk in, we go to the counter, and we just like start rattling off what we want, right? Because it's Culver's. And the ladies like looked at us, and she's like, you must be from Wisconsin.
How do you know what we have?
Yeah, they're legitimately like, they're like...
You didn't call it a Happy Meal?
No, you didn't have to like look at the menu. You didn't have to like, you didn't make mistakes or anything. And then the funny part is, yep, we're like, yeah, we are. I might have had a Badger shirt on or
wow,
something.
Wow, are you saying that? You said it like that, like, yeah, we are.
But
yeah, this is our place. You're welcome.
And can't you tell I eat Culver's all the time? Yeah.
Legitimately, half of the staff behind the counter was too.
From like, Wisconsin? Sure, they bring people in to like, train them, yeah.
Like the they manager.
Were hey, where are you guys from?
Yeah, the manager on duty was from De Pere.
Nice.
And like, it was crazy. Like, that's what they do. They bring in, you know, people who know what they're doing to get the new people started. But it was just funny because they picked us out right away because we just rattled off all the stuff we wanted. So,
you're Culver's experts.
Yep. It was like, what are the chances, right?
Did you have a pocket full of Scoopy coupons?
Oh, I'm sure. Yes.
Pulling out to pay for the meal. Like.
Those are like, that's Christmas gifts right there, man.
Yes.
I'd like my free ice cream right now, please.
So
this will be the fifth Culver's in the greater Fort Wayne area. So for being a thousandth there, they will know how to order properly. Right.
They won't stand befuddled in front of the menu.
I did actually stop at a Culver's driving through Indiana a couple of years ago. I don't remember exactly where it was, but I just remember thinking like, oh yeah, there's Culver's. Sweet.
Culver's is finding this weird niche of like,
I think they're like, even down in like Georgia now.
Some people don't consider it fast food almost. Like they've found a way to trick people into like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, because it's,
well, it's not really like,
it's not pre-made like, and
yeah,
waiting
it's
for
a little
you.
Bit
yeah.
better quality.
The best one was we went to Phoenix and we're like, seriously, there's a Culver's in Phoenix?
Well, that's where, where are all the Wisconsinites going to eat in the winter?
Right. Like, all the snowbirds are down there.
Yeah, that was a money trip when you're like, okay, we're in Phoenix. What are we going to eat? Culver's money.
Well, 1,000 of them, so that's pretty cool.
That's corny this week. Farmers remain concerned about the lack of a 5-year farm bill. So, Darkey County, Ohio farmer Matthew Altman says volatility in the ag industry is ongoing and farmers need some assurance. Biggest concern is getting a farm bill signed or a continuing resolution here at the end of the year, he said. And then look how that plays out. Ohio Farm Bureau President Bill Patterson says farmers and ranchers are going another year without an updated farm bill. How are we going to make sure that agriculture in the long term is viable? And is there a way that we can work together with government to make sure that we're supporting these farms through these times so that things look good on the other side? He tells Brownfield Ag News that with Republican control of the U.S. House, Senate, and a Republican president, getting a farm bill finished could be easier, but there are so many factions within that it could be hard to figure out a path forward. Agriculture needs will find something that just simply puts forth the programs that are really what is needed. So I thought the election would be the trigger, like once that was done, that maybe they'd get something done here before the end of the year, but not much has materialized on that front. So see what happens. Now for our Feel Good Friday to wrap things all up. So what happens when a poultry processor flies the coop? Well, a Wisconsin student helped farmers that were abandoned by Pure Prairie Poultry. So they suddenly closed their doors, which left a lot of farmers in multiple Midwest states scrambling. Many found themselves stuck with birds. They had nowhere to feed or no way to feed and nowhere to process. But as often happens in challenging times, good-hearted souls find a way to persevere. So Brianna Patz is a student at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, also from Seymour. She's studying engineering with a goal of one day helping design better manufacturing processes for birds and livestock. While still in high school, she founded Pips and Chicks, a business focusing primarily on poultry. It's become a popular community on social media where Patz often hosts virtual shows. So her grandfather had a dairy farm that she would help out on sometimes. She said, "I always grew up with animals around. I've had chickens for close to a decade now, and I've kind of fallen in love with poultry." In September, she was in Oklahoma participating in a UW River Falls Poultry and Swine Club event. During the trip, professor told the group about the Pure Prairie poultry situation, and she wanted to get involved, thanks to her professor. Patz learned of three local farmers struggling without a processor. Through conversations with them and others online, she connected with three additional Wisconsin farms. The stories she heard were heartbreaking: birds dying of starvation, some resorting to cannibalism. Farmers were doing everything they could to keep birds fed, but without Pure Prairie support, the cost came out of their own pockets. For some, the price was too much to bear. She posted a message on her Pips and Chicks Facebook site. Six farms she'd contacted had 150,000 to 175,000 birds that needed to be processed immediately. Anyone willing to pick them up could have them for a small donation or, in some cases, free of charge. As word spread online, Patz compiled a list of those willing to take and process the birds. She also coordinated volunteer drivers who would assist in the bird evacuations. As more volunteers stepped up, Patz posted information on travel routes and identified drivers that could take on additional birds. By October 16th, all the birds were gone. Patz thanked all the volunteers who contributed to the cause. "Took about 4 days from start to finish, and it was well beyond what I thought was possible," she said. So that's pretty darn cool.
She needs a job in marketing.
Yeah.
Organization. That's pretty cool.
So hopefully she is currently working with Farm Bureau and Wisconsin Republican Representative Derek Van Orden on potential legislation to keep this from happening again in the future. But, yeah, we'll see where that goes.
You feel bad. Those farms were... You have literally nowhere to go with it. Yeah, like how do you... Like at that point, too, you just... What do you even do with that? And this way where you could hook up potential people to give, you know, pay even a little money, but just sort of enough money and take them off your hands at that point. And yeah, that's really neat.
I mean, even 80 to 100 cow dairy losing their milk pickup is bad, but the cows don't start eating each other.
Right.
You usually have enough. But yeah, in this case, when you got all these birds and...
Birds are kind of
nowhere
mean.
To go, and yeah, chickens can be really nasty to each other.
So. And me.
Yeah.
And you. Yeah. You don't get along with chickens.
Yeah. Some people have spider fears. I have chicken phobias.
Chicken phobias.
Birds in general, but mainly chickens.
It's good to know.
Yeah. You just do you realize what you just told me?
I knew this. Open of you, the Bill. Pandora box.
I knew
here
this,
for
but
Matt.
I Matt did not.
Your birthday's coming up. Yes. So son of a can't wait.
Does fear of chickens have like a name?
I'm sure there is.
Yeah. Chicken phobia.
Electrophobia.
Electrophobia?
A-L-E-K-T-O-R-O phobia.
I would have thought like poultrophobia.
Is my, is my picture next to that?
Yes, picture.
Oh, it says, yeah, Bill. From the Greek words elector, meaning rooster. So, yes.
Okay.
Even more, as more afraid of the rooster than
fear the rooster.
I don't fear the reaper. I fear the rooster.
Thank you, Blue Oyster Cult.
Symptoms of this include increased fear, anxiety, sweating, rapid heart rate, chest tightness, difficult breathing.
Check.
So any fear, basically.
Yes.
Is what you're just describing. It's just fear. Yeah. It's just unrational fear of something that's like not even a third your size.
No, I remember when we had chickens growing up, I don't ever remember seeing you,
Bill,
with great-grandma and the chickens. Oh, no.
Into the coop to get the eggs.
No.
Would you defend yourself against the chickens? Would you like kind of push them away if they get near you? Or,
yeah, kicking and
punting the chickens.
Yeah. Yep.
Just learned a whole new side of you, Bill. It's good to know.
The worst is
won't come back to haunt you at all.
Shit.
The worst was what? Sorry.
Nothing.
Let's
stop right there.
Be more specific.
No, carry on. Yes, please. Tell me what is the worst aspect.
What specifically are you afraid of?
The beaks, claws, feathers?
Everything.
Everything. The whole package. Can you eat eggs?
Yeah, I love eggs.
All right. Yeah. Good.
He likes chicken, too.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, it's revenge for him. He's like, it's one less chicken in this world. Even though they're unfertilized. But anyway. That'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
I guess thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about pH and how it affects nutrient availability and how it's good to keep your pH in balance, not just for your hair products anymore. In our spotlight, we took a look at the 2024 National Corn Growers Association Corn Yield Contest with David Hula hitting 490 this year as the big winner. Egg History Minute, we talked about the America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance 2024 edition. Cool Beans this week was the 1,000th Culver's will be opening soon in Allen County, Indiana. That's Corny, still waiting on the farm bill. And Field Good Friday is a Wisconsin student helping poultry farms out in their time of need. So thanks for listening. And as always, happy farming.